This is Paul Morledge of the UW Oral History Project. Today is May 15th, 1998, and I am in the office of Professor Richard Heine in the Material Science and Engineering Building. And we're going to begin by talking about Professor Heine's childhood and the early years of schooling in Detroit.
Well, I went to an elementary school through the sixth grades. Then I went to what was called then an intermediate school, 7 through 9, and then I went to Eastern High School. That's about it. I enjoyed every bit of it.
Okay. Any comments about your childhood? Any significant events or?
Well, I had a happy childhood. My mother, unfortunately, my mother died when I was 9 years old, and my father and I were bachelors for quite a while. There wasn't any particular push toward any kind of education, educational objective. I did have an early aspiration to study geology because I enjoyed the outdoors, but I did not follow through on that.
Okay. Did any family members and or teachers influence direction of your studies or your life course?
No.
Okay. We're going to talk now about your higher education, employment, and military service. Why did you decide to enroll at Wayne State University?
Well, I got an academic scholarship from my high school. And I took chemical engineering because it seemed to be the broadest curriculum. And I didn't have any particular instructors or fellow students that influenced me. I did have one instructor in a metallurgy course that I particularly enjoyed that probably directed me toward that area.
Do you recall the instructor's name? Or?
Yes, he became a very prominent metallurgist. His name was Ernest Kirkendall, who became known for the Kirkendall effect in metallurgical circles.
Huh. Okay, and while attending Wayne State, you taught chemistry and physics at Detroit Eastern High School. Could you briefly discuss your first experience teaching and how, if at all, it influenced your later career choices?
Well, I taught in the nice school of Detroit Eastern High School, so that the students that I had were older students, and I enjoyed it very much. It encouraged me to perhaps consider teaching as a career. While I was at Wayne State University, I also had an assistantship in the fuels laboratory of the chemical engineering department, so I was pretty busy.
So a lot of the students you're teaching were actually older than you?
Yes.
Huh. In 1940, you graduated from Wayne State and worked at the Michigan Steel Casting Company as a melter and a metallurgical assistant. Why did you decide to work for this company in such a capacity?
In 1940, any job was a welcome job. I had just been married and I needed a job. This was one that came along and it turned out to be a very significant event in the rest of my career because I learned a great deal of metallurgy as a melter. As a melter, I was responsible for putting together the charged materials that were melted and produced the alloy composition that was the objective of a particular heat of steel. That was instrumental in exposing me to many different alloy steels, entire range of highly alloyed stainless and heat-resistant steels that are made to this very day. It was a very useful experience to me.
So would you say having this hands-on experience helped you out later on as a researcher? And
Without any question, it was very instrumental in giving me an understanding of the full scope of alloys as they existed at that time.
Okay. And that same year, you became an instructor of metallurgy at the General Motors Institute.
Well, that was not the same year. Oh. That was a later year. That was 1943.
Oh, okay.
Was it 43? Oh, no, wait a minute. It was 1940. Sure.
How did this position arise for you?
Well, I had made a contact with a professor at the University of Michigan where I intended to go to grad school. He told me of this position at General Motors Institute, and again, for financial reasons, I decided to take that, and was able to teach in the castings area, which had become my major interest.
Okay. And what courses did you teach, or course?
Well, I taught chemistry and metal casting. And General Motors Institute was a central technical institute funded by the General Motors Corporation. It has since become a state school. It's called General Motors. I can't remember the name, what it's called now, but it's probably called General Motors Institute of Technology. It's part of the Michigan University system.
Oh, it's part of the state school system, though?
It is now, yeah. But it wasn't at that time.
Was the institute just for people who are going to be employed by General Motors, or was it just for...
It was a cooperative engineering school, and the students that went there alternated between periods of work and periods at the school. So they were very practically oriented students.
Okay. And you decided to enlist in the Navy in 1943 in the thick of World War II, and you became a lieutenant in the Naval Ordnance Engineering Division. What was your role in the U.S. war effort?
My role in the U.S. war effort was largely teaching. As soon as they discovered that I was an engineering educator, they decided that was the best place to use me, and so that's what I did for the rest of the time. But my primary instruction was in naval ordnance munitions. I did have a period in the Naval Gun Factory Foundry.
And where were you stationed?
Where was I stationed?
Yeah.
Oh, I was stationed at Fort Schuyler, New York, and then subsequently at the Naval Air Station in Jacksonville, Florida, and after that Port Hueneme, California, which was a point of embarkation.
Okay. And 1946, shortly after the end of the war, you became supervisor of foundry instruction at the General Motors Institute.
Well, my return to General Motors Institute after I was discharged from the Navy did not really change my duties at General Motors Institute at all. Again, it was a matter of instruction in chemistry and metal casting courses.
Okay, so you just supervised the instruction at this point instead of...
No, I was involved in instruction.
Okay. And after working for the General Motors Institute, you enrolled at the University of Wisconsin for graduate study in metallurgical engineering. When and why did you choose to study metallurgical engineering?
Well, I had become interested in that field, beginning with my work at the Michigan Steel Castings Company. And that interest grew, and I enjoyed it, so I wanted to continue to do that study in that field.
Okay. And why did you decide to enroll at the University of Wisconsin College of Engineering?
Well, there was a department chairman here, George J. Barker, a very kind man, who through some committee work with the American Foundrymen Society came to know him through that, and he invited me to come here as an instructor in the metal casting field. Why did I enroll?
So you originally came here as an instructor?
Yes.
And then you slowly decided to enter the graduate program?
No, I came here for a combination of graduate study and as an instructor.
And what courses, instructors, and or fellow students influence you the most here at University of Wisconsin?
Well, I'd like to mention Professor Philip C. Rosenthal, who was the professor who was actually, you might say, supervising the casting program. He was a mentor to me and a very excellent educator. He also had a unique ability to teach metallurgical thermodynamics in a way that students could understand, which was a great benefit to me.
And you used some of those same methods that you taught later on, or?
Yes, I've been using them ever since.
Okay, and we're gonna cover some of your research here at the UW-COE. Your principal interests were all in, quote, all phases of metallurgy associated with foundry practice. Discuss, if you would, how your research interests in the following areas arose and how they evolved over time.
I became involved in the Wisconsin chapter of the American Foundryman Society and also the Foundry Educational Foundation. Both of these societies are aimed at encouraging education, particularly undergraduate education of engineering students. Through those societies, I became acquainted with many owners and operators, managers of foundry companies in the state of Wisconsin particularly, but on a broader scale in different parts of the country. So the various aspects of the foundry process, casting process, that I came in contact with evolved out of my conversations with these people and a significant number of visits to their physical plants, their physical facilities where they did their casting operations. In this connection, the cast irons are produced in a greater tonnage than all other casting alloys combined. So it would be quite normal in the course of events to become greatly interested in gray and malleable and ductile iron metallurgical practices. And I had quite a number of graduate students looking at different aspects of these processes and also receiving graduate degrees in connection with them, at, either in the master's or PhD level, depending on the particular technical aspect they were studying, researching. All of these materials were in the early stages of their technical development. So there was a great deal of work to be done to improve a basic understanding of these materials and to produce them more efficiently and with fewer defective processes and castings. And that was the aim of much of my work. In the course of being interested in these castings, it's important to recognize that these castings are made in molds, and the preponderant molding material is what's called green molding sand. That's simply a moist mixture of clay and silica sand and some additives that enhance its behavior. And at the time that I came to the university initially, in 1947, the industry was still primarily using what are called natural molding sands. Such molding sands were used and are described in the Old Testament portion of the Bible when Solomon's temple was built. Casting expert was a man by the name of Hiram, and he made these castings in the clay of the ground of the plain of Jordan. And if you understand what that means immediately that this is a material that is comprised of about 15 to 20% natural clay, and the balance is largely silica sand. Those were the kinds of sands that were in operation when I came to the University of Wisconsin. The Kohler Company was using such sands to make their enamelware castings, bathtub sinks, etc. Many other foundries were using such sands. Here is an example of a technology that didn't change at all over quite a few centuries. Early in this time, that is, following World War II and continuing on through the 50s, the switch to what are called synthetic sands became complete. Synthetic sand being a sand built up from the best clay available, which happens to be a product of the Western Plains in Wyoming and South Dakota and Montana, etc., the volcanic clay and relatively pure silica sand, which we have a great deal of in Wisconsin, particularly in Portage and near Green Lake, Wisconsin. Those are mined for making synthetic sands and also for making cores, which create the interior spaces, contours of castings.
Can I ask something really quick? Did you have anything to do with the conversion to synthetic sands?
I published a great deal of information that has been used and continues to be used in formulating and applying the practice of synthetic sands. As a matter of fact, on Monday afternoon, together with co-authors from two prominent foundry companies in Wisconsin, presented a discussion, or a paper, I should say, on the properties of such sands and the best ways to measure them and control their behavior. So this is an ongoing process for me to continue to do research in this field. Fortunately, at this time, I have done enough basic work so that I can participate in the foundry applications to a much better degree than what most people could.
Okay.
Where are we? Oh, yeah, synthetic sands. That's why I got interested in molding sands. Because when you make castings, you discover that the metal that you pour into a mold doesn't ignore the mold. It will react with the mold, and you need to understand the nature of the reactions between the metal and the mold. And that led me into the study of molding sands. It also led to a study of the design of castings and how that relates to the solidification process and a necessity which is called risering. In solidification of metals, there is an inherent volume contraction during solidification. That volume contraction must be compensated by introducing enough additional metal late in the freezing process so that there will not be a shrinkage void internally, but the casting will be sound. That led to a study of the connection between the design of the casting and the subject of risering. Risering means providing reservoirs where that metal that compensates for shrinkage will be provided. Again, you have an interaction between the particular material, the particular kind of mold, the design of the casting, and what needs to be done to produce a sound casting. And of course, as a consequence of these various processes, one enters into a study of all of the processes and their relationship to each other. And that is an ongoing thing because the quality of our castings has been improving tremendously, particularly over the last 10 years. I should mention in this connection that one of the areas that's been important has been what is called thermal analysis. That means following the solidification process by thermal analysis of it, particularly through the use of cooling curves. That's a temperature time process of measurement. And again, each one of the alloys mentioned, plus many others in the foundry field, such as the aluminum alloys, bronzes, and so on, have characteristic solidification modes, and as a consequence, they have characteristic cooling curve behavior. Analyzing that leads to an understanding of the solidification mechanism and how that's involved in the solidification process for risering, or the risering for the solidification process. Also, it enables one to relate to some other fundamental considerations of the field of metallurgy that you're concerned with, namely the relationship of composition to constitutional diagrams, being impure type, a diagram which presents the information for an impure alloy as contrasted with phase diagrams, which are primarily for very pure materials, material systems. Again, I with my co-authors who are from Nina Foundry Company and Grady Reedsburg plant, presented a paper on Tuesday morning of this week on thermal analysis of their particular grades of cast irons and their relationship to the kind of melting process that's they practice, the chemistry they practice, and so forth. This, again, is an ongoing consequence of the research that I've done in the past and continue to do. Welding and heat treating. Well, many castings are heat treated, so to enhance their properties, and so I have studied in that area. And although my work in welding is rather limited, although I did receive an award for what was done by the American Welding Society. At any rate, continuing, one would realize that all of this work in today's situation requires that it be implemented or recorded and implemented and followed through the use of a variety of computer programs and computing equipment. And that, of course, has been done and is being done. Computer-aided design of castings so that they will most favorably solidify for, I'm not saying that right, so that their solidification process will occur in a design which is most favorable for producing high-quality casting. And that has been the aim of some of the work that I've done more recently with Professor John Euchre in the Mechanical Engineering Department. That's not my area, that is the programming or the development of such methods is not my area, but the consequences are. And so that's why we, Professor Euchre and I have had a very excellent cooperative effort in this area.
When you, excuse me, when you say consequences, you mean comparing the computer design moldings versus those that aren't, and seeing how much more efficient
One of the things that can be done, for example, is to take an original design by an engineering designer. That's a geometric shape, and analyzing it from the standpoint of the manner in which it would solidify, temperature versus time, and then from that, detecting whether there would be areas where defects would occur, namely shrinkage defects, and then changing the design so that to avoid that. All that would be done by a geometric analysis of the shape of the casting and the solidification that would occur within that shape. That's Professor Euchre's contribution. My contribution is to determine how the alloy fits into that system, how the metallurgical characteristics of the alloy fit into that system. Now, this is an area which has tremendously developed in foundry circles. At the foundry convention, which I just attended in Atlanta, there were a number of exhibitors of these kinds of programs, and many of them incorporate the work that was done by Professor Euchre and the concepts that I advocated through that. So that's been a very beneficial side effect of the previous work that I've done. Going on into recycling of metals, I would like to say this, that during the period of my studies in this field, the materials that are melted to make castings particularly in the cast irons, have substantially changed from largely virgin materials, for example, pig irons, which come from the initial reduction of the iron ore, meaning that largely virgin materials, some added, what you might call recycled scrap, but a relatively minor portion, to this time, in the case of the cast irons, probably 95% or more of the metal that is made into castings has had a previous existence as a casting or steel sheet metal from trucks and automobiles or railroad vehicles that have been scrapped. And so this is a what you might call a very excellent example of virtually 100% recycling, reuse of materials that have had the...
So they've been recycling metals a lot longer than they've been recycling a lot of other things.
Oh, that's really funny. I was reading the Bible the other day in the Old Testament, and in one of those times when the children of Israel disobeyed the Lord, he sent them he sent them the Chaldeans, who defeated them in battle and tore down some of the castings that were originally made for Solomon's temple. And they were bronze. And they broke them up and took them back to their country to make them into their own castings. So, you know, recycling is as old as the casting industry is, really. I think that's very funny. You know, we tend to think that we've invented everything new here, but that's a lot not the case at all. Recycling is, you know, several thousand years or more old.
Right.
Whoever defeated whoever took all the goods and used it their way.
Well, they would reheat it and
sure, just remelt it and make the castings they wanted. I think that's hilarious. Anyway, let's see, where am I? Oh, management of foundry solid wastes. Back in somewhere around 1970, the push from the environmental
movement,
the environmental movement, became evident to foundry people, and they began to realize that there were some things that they had to do in order to, you might say, clean up their act. And one of the first of those had to do with the foundry solid wastes going to landfill locations and then having water percolate through it and join the groundwater and possibly contaminate the groundwater. That was that was pushed quite a lot by the fact that some of the materials that were in the sand waste, this is largely the sand, had some phenolic materials in them.
I'm sorry?
Some phenolic.
Oh, phenols.
From phenols, right. And that was, of course, recognized as being potentially harmful. So the Foundry Society began to became alarmed about this and decided to do something about it in terms of actually discovering what would percolate, what water would carry that percolated through foundry sand wastes. And so they established a program that was carried on in the civil engineering department from the standpoint of the measurement of the contaminants that the water might pick up in percolating through foundry sand wastes. The other part of it was conducted in our department under my direction, and that was concerned with characterizing what constituted foundry wastes. So we did some material balances in which the foundries cooperated by measuring by weight all of the ingredients that they took sent to a foundry waste disposal site, measuring them by weight over a period of time so that they knew what the stream was that was going to the site where the waste was stored. When I say they measured them by the type. For example, sand waste, molding sand waste, core sand waste, slag from melting.
What's slag?
Well, those are oxides that accumulate whenever you melt a metal that's to be cast, or whenever you melt metal, there's a certain amount of oxidation that takes place, and that's slag. Not only were these materials melted, were these materials accumulated when they went to the landfill after they had been used, but in some cases, some of the material went to the landfill before it experienced heat from the metal. This is a matter of some of the stuff being falling on foundry floors and being swept up and never.
They were measured by volume?
I was on foundry wastes. Yeah, they were measured by weight so that you could determine, you could characterize a foundry waste by the percentage by weight of the different contributors to that waste. That's a material balance approach. At the same time, the foundries also provided records of how much material they bought. So there had to be a balance between the incoming material and the outgoing material. And that was accomplished. And this research was very instrumental in determining the course of much of this kind of work after that. For example, the civil engineering department developed tests for measuring what would be dissolved by water from the waste that's being produced. And their testing methods were initially adopted by the Environmental Protection Agency and have been expanded and altered somewhat for different circumstances, but it was the starting point of that kind of measurement.
Are you referring to like Professor Hamm and...
Oh, yeah, Professor Hamm.
And Boyle?
Boyle, right.
Okay.
Yeah, they were the initiators of that study and in the civil engineering department.
So you collaborated with them in a sense?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. We worked very closely together. In fact, we provided them with the materials from the foundries. And where was I? The idea of having a material balance, which is, you know, very characteristic of chemical engineering approach to any process of that kind, which we developed here for foundry waste, was subsequently copied by many other waste disposal activities as a way of characterizing the waste. So that was quite an important study, and the early papers on that came out in the very early 70s, and that's been growing and growing ever since. There was something else. Oh, I know. We had a very interesting conclusion to that study at the university area. Namely, we produced a group of lysimeters. These were vessels in which the waste materials were put in according to the different types of materials. These were subsequently exposed over in the Biotron to cycles of weathering over a year's time. And the water, the rainfall, and so forth and so on, that would percolate through were collected for analysis by the civil engineering department. See?
They simulated Midwestern climate? Or
the climate that was simulated at that time was Jackson, Michigan. Because at that particular time, the center of the tonnage was...
Oh, okay.
not that it was actually in Jackson, but in this area around here, that
right.
was the typical weather that was simulated. So that was a very interesting study. And
so the Biotron could do pretty accurate simulations then, huh?
Well,
pretty,
it gave pretty, a simulation. Yeah. There's nothing as accurate as
well, no, I know. I just
natural
wasn't,
one. And of course,
I know how capable it was.
You know, as a consequence of this, why they have put into landfills a variety of means of picking up what's coming, water that's coming through, and so forth and so on, so they can check up on what's actually happening compared to what happened in our studies. That was a very pleasant study, and I had a number of grad students that did master's degrees in that area, and so that was very good. Management of foundry solid waste. Professor Loper has done quite a lot of work in that area too. Beneficial reuse is the thing that's going on at the present time of foundry sands in particular.
They define it as beneficial reuse though, huh?
Yeah, beneficial reuse means taking the sand, this is particularly now the moly sand, and using it for various purposes. Like, for example, you can use it for covering municipal landfill as a covering.
Well, you can use molding sands as a covering?
Yes, you can.
Wow.
It's also used in road construction for filling in slopes and berms and stuff like that, you know.
So now they don't only recycle the metal, they recycle the moldings.
Well, you can call it recycling, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean it is in a sense.
Putting it back into the ground.
Yeah.
See, all of practically all of the things that go into the molding sand are naturally occurring materials. Silica sand, we got it all over under us. The clay is a naturally occurring material. There's a certain amount of coal put in. Well, that's a naturally occurring material also. And of course, carbon in the ground becomes useful to improve the quality of the soil. So.
Okay. When we first sat down together, you said, quote, much of my work was instrumental in bringing change to the castings industry, end quote. Can you give any examples, if you would, on how your research findings led to practical changes in the foundry industry?
Well, changes incrementally, rather slowly. But it does change. For example, early in my career, malleable iron castings were a very high tonnage item, namely near 900 to a million tons a year were produced. Ductile iron had just been invented by, the process it's used was invented by researchers from the International Nickel Company, Keith Millis in particular. That material was just coming into use, but over time, that has become the dominant iron for replacement of malleable iron. And I don't remember what the tonnage annually is in the United States, but it's substantially over a million tons. The total cast iron tonnage in the United States has always run somewhere between 10 million and 16 million tons a year. At any rate, that was an incremental change. We did a lot of work initially. When I say we, Professor Loper and his grad students and my grad students were involved in quite a number of research projects that made it possible to produce ductile iron much more consistently than had been the case early on. It's very difficult to point to one specific thing that revolutionized the whole business because, as I said, these are incremental changes that, when you begin to put them together, represent major changes. But it's difficult to point to one particular thing that would represent a major contribution, I guess possibly with one exception. Professor Loper and I published a paper jointly, it was a very long time ago, I don't remember exactly what year, but what it pointed out was that the results of producing good quality ductile iron are process dependent. You cannot ensure that by controlling the chemical composition, you will get the ductile iron quality that you want. The iron responds to a variety of process variables aside from composition. Temperatures involved in the processing, the introduction of other factors such as inoculation of the solidification process, the time period over which the iron is processed, the charged materials, et cetera, et cetera. There are many process variables that influence the quality of the iron that is finally poured into the casting and the casting resultant. We wrote on a number of these variables over time, and that has had a major impact on the quality of ductile iron produced. Now, you might find that that there would be a number of people that feel that they have contributed the same amount of or quality or whatever you, however you want to measure it, to improving the ductile iron process. And I wouldn't quarrel with that because, as I mentioned, improvements in the industry, which have been very substantial, is incremental as each of these considerations is worked into the overall process. And that goes back to one of the important topics that I have talked about earlier and which you have listed in this thing, and that's foundry process analysis. That was a very important part of that work. And it's still true today that many investigators do not understand the fact that they may get results that are in disagreement with another's investigator merely because their processing was not did not involve the same details. That confuses people who are accustomed to working with two or three components or two or three possible changes. This is further complicated by the fact that it is a recycling industry, and as a consequence, you have accumulating debris from previous uses, which are usually associated with residual elements. For example, lead contamination is very injurious to cast irons. And well, I could name some more, but the general idea is that the total process is under study all the time because it keeps changing as our technical environment changes.
Seems like lead contaminates everything.
Well,
catalytic converters.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm sure it's here for a reason.
Yeah. Did you want to talk about that?
If you were a collector of pewter,
right? Yeah, you wouldn't say it's
contaminated. It would be 95% tin and 5% if it was good pewter. If it wasn't, it might have a lot more lead in it.
Oh.
Even so, you'd still use it for utensils.
Yeah.
Food utensils.
Do you want to mention anything more about practical changes in the foundry industry, or would you like to go on?
Well, I did mention the molding sand business, and we were very instrumental in the proper use and development of synthetic molding sands. I mentioned the paper that I had just given, and that was an example of the fact that we progressively developed higher clay content molding sands that synthetic sands that are the basis of most of the iron casting molds made. The molds made for iron castings today
Okay, in 1984, you were quoted by a UW science writer saying, quote, "If you don't make castings, you don't have an economy." Do you think this is as true today as it was in the past?
Yes, it is. Nothing happens without castings.
Even plastics?
Well, you can't make
farm
machinery without castings. You can make the outside covering, but if you want to make an engine, you have to have castings.
I guess I was thinking more in the computer realm.
Computers don't make castings.
No, I know, but I mean,
I understand
the component parts are made by castings.
Well, as soon as you talk about computers, you're talking about a big variety of materials. If you consider all of the plastic things that are in it, they are made in metal molds.
Plastics are made in metal molds.
Right. Plastic shapes are made in metal molds.
Okay. And the metal molds are made by sand molds.
Well, the metal molds, you can make them as castings or you can make them as machined out of solid blocks of steels. There are different ways of doing that. But let's consider plastics. Plastics come primarily from the ground. Petroleum. See, that's the feedstock for making most plastics. Well, how do you get the petroleum out of the ground?
Through machinery that was made by castings.
Well,
so that are castings.
It's not just castings alone.
Yeah.
Metallic iron, let's put it that way. Steel, castings, and so forth. If you are going to develop power components, then you are very likely going to involve castings. If you're going to have ships on the oceans, well, you have a lot of iron and a lot of castings, a lot of steel, and so forth and so on. Yeah, so you have to realize that all steel starts out as a casting.
Can you explain that?
Well, sure. Going back to the making of steel, there are two ways of ending up with steel in the form of sheet or plates or I-beams or whatever the shapes are.
Right.
Everything you see around here. Sheet metal. Two ways to get to that. One is to cast an ingot. All that is
I'm
a
sorry?
Cast an ingot.
Ingot.
I-N-G-O-T.
Okay.
That's nothing more than a big rectangular object.
Okay.
Tall, about three times, maybe five times as tall as it is square, whatever its shape is. Take that, heat it up, and roll it. Hot work it, in other words. You roll it down, you can roll it down into sheet, or you can roll it into I-beams or whatever, make pipe out of it, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
It starts out as a casting. That's a static casting. It can also, steel can also be continuous cast. Square blocks. Molten metal is poured into a mold that is water-cooled. It begins to solidify. Is removed, bent, and then that's subsequently rolled. Okay.
Hmm.
That's continuous casting, followed by rolling to whatever shape you want. Again, I'll show you a piece of it. The old days, if you go back to the times of the 1700s, you would be making vessels like that out of cast iron castings because steel was not available like that in those days. That's the development that has come since around 1700. That's been changing progressively.
So was the metal back in the 1700s a lot more brittle than?
No, not necessarily. Steel could be made but in very, very small batches. So nothing like we have, you know, today, you see.
But the actual quality of the metal isn't all that much different.
Well, there were, the quality of the metal went back to the quality of the ore that it came from. And there were certain steels that had unique properties due to the fact that they had high purity ores. Scandinavian countries, particularly Sweden, were fortunate to have iron ore that was of high purity. Hmm. But again, you're talking about very limited amounts of material available. See? This particular steel is made by continuous casting, a 9-inch by 9-inch block.
Professor Heine's pointing out a sort of a sheet metal that can be bent in different shapes.
Yeah, it can be made into a wash basin or a bathtub, porcelain enameled, and you see it as usually a white object or some colored enamel object.
But you mean they pour the enamel over the metal? And then it's fused onto the metal.
Yeah, okay. Now, in contrast, you could have a bathtub or a basin, which is made of polymers, plastics.
Which they do nowadays, a lot of.
Well, yeah. Take your pick.
Yeah.
We've had both kinds in the homes that we've lived in. And one of the problems with the polymer, the washbowls we had, the hot water gradually crazed the polymer.
Gradually what?
Crazed it, made a bunch of little tiny cracks with hot water.
Huh.
But that's not necessary. They can overcome that by manipulating the quality of the polymer, see? But I want to point out, before they made that, they had to get the polymer, the raw material, the oil, out of the ground first. And that involved mining equipment. Then they had to form it in a dye, which is usually an iron alloy of some kind. And so forth and so on.
Okay. And you've already mentioned a few biblical references regarding the importance of casting and recycling to mankind. Do you care to comment on the other religious connections to your work, your research, your editorial?
Is that in here somewhere?
I'm going to mention a few more things about if you don't make castings, you don't have an economy.
How do you want to get where you're going? Americans are always going someplace. You always have to have transportation, don't you?
Right.
Transportation involves machinery. Well, anytime you have systems that involve machinery, you will have castings.
Okay.
You know, railroad castings.
Yeah, right, everything.
The engines of trucks and buses and automobiles and trains and so forth and so on. I was recently involved in some quality questions on the production of a 6,000 horsepower locomotive diesel cylinder block. Well, you know, we more or less take it for granted that we're going to have locomotive diesels moving back and forth on the rails, et cetera, et cetera. You don't have an economy if you don't have castings.
Right.
That's not going to change. The nature of the castings may change. For example, we have a big movement in the direction of aluminum cylinder blocks as a replacement for cast iron cylinder blocks. Well, that's just a change from one kind of metal to another kind, but it's still a casting.
Right.
One of the reasons for that is that there's no way that you can make a geometric shape that's as complicated as a cylinder block except by casting it. There isn't any other way to do it.
No conceivable way even in the future.
No, I'm not going to predict the future.
Okay.
But at the present time...
Well, I'll ask you to eventually, so get ready for it.
Well, Anyway, on the subject of you don't have an economy, I could go on and on with that, but...
Well, essentially, you don't have technology without it.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, you don't
that's
have...
Right. Not only that, but there's one more important thing, and that is you cannot defend your country without castings. Okay.
Missiles?
Well, whatever. You cannot defeat a country unless you can occupy a country. Saddam Hussein is a good example of that. Okay. In order to occupy a country, you have to have the equipment that will move men and ordnance to occupy a country. If you want to defend yourself, you have to have the same equipment to counteract whatever is trying to invade. Our country is in a serious position at the present time because we don't have that capability to the degree that we did have.
Can you speak a little more about that?
That's
interesting.
We have the delusion abroad that wars have come to a conclusion, that we have a peace dividend that we can divide up among all kinds of other places, and we can cut back on our preparedness budget. Not so at all. Not so at all. If anything, we're at more risk now than we were before the Russian breakup and the Gulf War and all that jazz. Hmm. People just don't want to face up to the reality.
Good. Before we end today, you want to just quickly touch on any other biblical references?
I just assume quit now.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, we'll finish.
One reason I want to quit is because.